We Made This. Welcome back, everybody, to the Movie Palace. I'm your host, as ever, Carl Sweeney, and thank you for joining me for another episode, first new episode in a while. And this week, I'm going to be talking about a book that was published by Candlewick Press in September. It is called Beauty Mark, a verse novel of Marilyn Monroe. It was written by Carol Boston Weatherford, and I'm delighted to be joined to discuss the book by Clara Cook. Hi, Clara.
Hi, Carl.
How are you doing, Clark? It's been a little while. We spoke a few months ago with Kelechi, didn't we, about cinemas reopening and all that stuff. And, well, at least all that sorted, you know. It's all in the past.
No, well, how's it going? They all opened and then some of them closed. And yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's going, I mean, well, I'm healthy. I think that's the main thing that everyone can say is a marker of being sort of well in 2020.
Yeah.
I think other areas of my life have definitely suffered. I haven't seen a film in the cinema.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think that in terms of, you know, still being here on this planet and, you know, still making it through, I think I'm doing pretty okay, to be honest.
I'm glad to hear that, because I mean, as we were just discussing just before we pressed record, but you said something on that previous podcast which I think is very insightful. I thought about it quite a bit over the last few months. You were saying about how the reopening would be an interesting experience for a lot of people and a difficult one. And I think it has been, hasn't it, for many people. So to have got as far as we have, we're, you know, reaching the end of the year. I think that classes an achievement for 2020, like you say, doesn't it?
Yeah. I think the challenge will be after this year is how people cope in 2021, but also just how people cope in the long term after this. Because I think something like this over a certain period of time, which is quite a long period of time now, I mean, almost the whole year, does have an effect on people's minds and brains long term. So, and I think some things are going to change completely. I don't think cinema is going to be, I think it'll change, but I don't think it's going to die. And as much as the arts are suffering right now, I don't think they're going to die because there's always demand for arts. And there are some buildings in London that are purpose built. Cinemas are purpose built for one thing. Same with theatres. But I think in terms of people working, or, I mean, we're just talking about Zoom, you know, like, or people talking to each other online, a lot of that stuff might be forever changing. People might be doing a lot more stuff remotely now in the future. So, and there's also an impact to that as well, an impact on people and people's view of the world. So we'll see how that goes.
Okay, let's think a bit about this book then. So thank you, first of all, to Candlewick Press for providing both of us with copies of the book to review, which is really nice. How are you approaching this, Clara, before you read it, before we get to the book specifically? Because I read an interview with the author, Carol Boston Weatherford. All these quotes I've drawn from her today. They're from an interview she did with hereweread.com. And she was sort of talking about the appeal of writing this book. And she said, to me, Marilyn was not just a movie star. She was a mood and a mystery. Her life was a poem. So before we even think about the book, I suppose, were you coming to this as a Marilyn Monroe fan, particularly?
No, not at all. In fact, I'll admit, it's very awful, but I knew almost nothing about Marilyn Monroe. I mean, I knew of her. She's a cultural icon.
Yeah.
I would say she's even gone beyond that now, and she's almost a symbol. So I knew of her. I had seen a few movies that she'd been in, although, to be honest, whenever I watched those movies, I wasn't really focusing on her because she was sort of in the background. There was one film I watched as a small child called River of No Return, where I remember her being in that. And I think I focused on her much more in that because she has a much more main role. But I mean, she always seemed like quite a tragic character in my mind. Yeah. And so I wasn't necessarily really well educated on her. So this book allowed me to actually go and learn more about her, which was definitely really interesting.
Yeah.
I have quite mixed feelings about how people perceive her after reading this book and also after doing more research.
You know, when you talk about her being in the background, are you thinking of films like All About Eve? Because we spoke about that before, didn't we? I think we did like a 2-hour podcast almost, and I don't think we mentioned her. Maybe we did in passing, but obviously not a focal point. Is that the kind of thing you mean?
Yes, I do, yeah. And also Oh, there's another film, Cash by Night, is it called? I think, where she's in, it's Barbara Stanwyck. And I think I watched that film and I was entirely focused on Barbara Stanwyck. But looking back on it now and like rewatching parts of it for this podcast, I was like, God, you know, I can't believe I didn't really notice Marilyn Monroe more. But I actually felt a little bit bad because I feel like I completely misjudged her. I mean, she's not going to care. and no one's going to really care what I think. But I think that I feel like I sort of misjudged her. Like, I mean, to be honest, famous women in history often get misjudged or they get remembered for something in particular that isn't necessarily really who they are. So I think that's kind of what I was doing with her. And this book, not only the book itself allowed me to find out more about her, but it also allowed me to, it pushed me to do more research and pushed me to read up more about her and to watch more clips of her films and more sort of interviews with her and like clips of her acting and stuff. And I watched Misfits, The Misfits, which I'd never watched before because of this book, and really changed the way I saw her.
I haven't seen The Misfits yet. I mean, I'm not sure I'm dedicated enough to call myself a Marilyn Monroe fan. I haven't seen all of her films. I've seen quite a few of them, but I do, I guess, appreciate her. I think there are some films like Some Like It Hot or The 7 Year Itch that I think they only work as well as they do because of her. In the case of The 7 Year Itch, I'm not sure the film would work particularly well if she wasn't in it. I feel like she's somebody, and maybe you're kind of alluding to this, I think her iconic status, it's not necessarily reflected, in my opinion, in the quality of her filmography overall. I mean, there are some highlights there. I think most of the films she starred in are not great necessarily. I mean, you can say that about lots of other figures too. And it obviously doesn't detract from her legacy. I mean, we're here, what, almost six decades after she died. I think she has that degree of recognisability that probably few stars of that era have today. Is that what you kind of mean when you say she's a symbol? Do you mean the fact that she still appears on T-shirts and that kind of thing? Is that what's kind of what you mean?
Yeah, and I think she also kind of defined the era a little bit. I mean, not her personally on her own. I mean, there were plenty of other famous figures at the same time that also defined the era. But she's sort of like the start of this very overt sort of sexualization that we have in our society. I mean, she sort of represents like obvious sexuality. Do you know what I mean? I mean, I'd like to call it I would like to call it sexual freedom, but I don't really feel like she's representing sexual freedom at all, actually. And I mean, I'd like to say that, but I don't think I, as a feminist, I really don't feel like I can say that. And but it's like, I guess it's a ability to be able to be sexual in public or to sort of show off your sexuality in a world where that is kind of appropriate. But I mean, I don't know if it's appropriate. She was before the sort of sexual revolution, kind of, but sort of the start of it. You know, I mean, you know, like the sort of before the era of free love and everything. But just kind of, she kind of like sort of trigger sort of start of it. But also, that look, you know, the platinum bond, the makeup, like the beauty mark. You know, like it's very iconic, and she sort of represents this sort of era where people were starting to experiment more with being overtly sexual and flirtatious and stuff like that. And I think, I feel a similar way about her as I do about Elvis, you know, like you kind of get blinded by all the rhinestones and the shaking hips and, you know, you kind of get blinded by it, but you don't actually realize that Elvis was very musically talented or had his own particular thoughts about things. They cease to become people and they start to become this cartoon almost.
Yeah, that's it, I think. I think with Monroe, I think there were disparate sides to that image. So, like, she could play the dumb blonde, and I'll put that in quote marks, it's not a very nice phrase, but she played that to a T. So there's a quote from Some Like It Hot, which I think, you know, real diamonds, they must be worth their weight in gold. That kind of comment, you know. And, yeah, just I know that when I was researching the Some Like It Hot podcast I did a while back, I was looking at a book called Heavenly Bodies, written by a guy called Richard Dyer. He basically put forward the idea that there are all these divides and debates around women's sexuality in the 50s, because you had like the Kinsey Report on one hand, you had things like Playboy launched on the other. I think Monroe was the first Playboy centerfold, wasn't she? Because
She didn't give her permission for that, though. That's another thing that you do wonder how much of. Anyway, yeah, you do wonder how much of her that this was her choice and how much of
this
it was.
This is it. So the idea being that part of her significance is because she sort of is illustrative, or she embodies some of these debates about what it's like to be sexualized or a sexualized woman in the contemporary Western world. But then you sort of look beyond some of the sort of surface elements and you see there's a real vulnerability to her and to some of her characters. And I think if you look at her interviews, and I think in this book it comes through too, you realize that there's much more than meets the eye. She's part of the reason, which is part of the reason why she continues to fascinate people. We continue to get books like this. So this book, written by Carol Boston Weatherford, New York Times bestselling author and poet, who has written numerous books for children about one called Becoming Billie Holiday, one called Moses, When Harriet Tubman Led Her People to Freedom, and quite a few other titles too. Now, I haven't read anything of hers apart from this book now, Clara. Were you familiar with this author at all?
No. I'm now curious to read the book that she's written by Harriet Tubman.
Yeah.
That sounds really good. Or Billie Holiday. I mean, Billie Holiday also had a really interesting life. So, also another person that I think is kind of overshadowed by her larger-than-life sort of status. But I think it's interesting that she's taking... So this is what one of the things I was going to ask was, who is this book for? Because there's some themes in it that are very adult that I'm not sure would be appropriate for young people. I'm thinking children, maybe teenagers, but children. But I also felt the book itself was introducing Marilyn to an audience that perhaps didn't know anything about her.
Yeah.
And that kind of suggested to me young adults or children. But I also was reading it. I was thinking, I don't think this is also appropriate. So I was kind of confused. And if she's writing about other famous women, it's quite possible that she's, if they are books and similar, like they're fictionalized accounts of real people, I was wondering if it is possible that she's writing these books for people who, for young adults. I was thinking like teenagers who are being introduced to these famous icons for the first time.
So I've got a quote from her where she talks about hoping the book would be more appealing to reluctant readers who are put off by the dense text in novels. And then some of the websites I've looked at seem to suggest this is aimed at grade 9 upwards. So I'll confess, I had to look that up because we have a different system over here. But grade 9 is age 14, I think. So, I don't know, it's quite hard for me to remember what it was like to be 14. It's 20 years ago now. I wasn't a reluctant reader at that age. I like to read. So it's interesting, isn't it? Because also the verse novel form as well. Like, I wonder if that's, in some ways, could be a barrier, just like the idea of poetry. Because, like, I was thinking about... I don't know if you saw this when the Oscars happened, when Bong Joon-ho won for Parasite, when he was on that circuit anyway, I don't think this was at the Oscars, but he talked about once you overcome the one-inch-tall barrier of subtitles, you'll be introduced to so many more amazing films. And I was wondering if this was kind of similar, that maybe a lot of people have the idea that poetry is difficult or boring or, you know, passé or whatever. And I think some of those preconceptions could be quite difficult to overcome. But I wonder if they can get past that, approach the book in an open-minded way. I wonder, I don't know if many teenagers would enjoy this because of the sort of approach it takes. What's your feeling on that? I don't know.
Well, first of all, I don't want to engender things, but I'm not sure how much this would appeal to 14-year-old boys. So yeah. I think in general, it would probably appeal more to 14-year-old girls. I know that's an awful thing to say, but books are marketed to girls and boys. Unfortunately, they're not marketed as something to both genders. I think a 14-year-old girl probably would enjoy this. As a 14-year-old girl myself, I wasn't an avid reader. I wasn't put off by big portions of text. And one of the things that did frustrate me about this book was that I did want to know more. At the end of each little verse, I felt like still hungry. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So when I finished it wasn't like I read it in an hour. It took some time. It's a substantial read. It's not, you know, it's not like something that's going to take you 45 minutes or something. You can spend, you know, a day or two reading it. But I did feel kind of like slightly unsatisfied because of that. I felt like I wanted more but that's very particular to me, you know, because I don't like short internet articles. I like long reads, you know, I like long yeah. books. So that's one of the things I felt. I don't necessarily mind the verse format though. I've read other books in verse. The one that I really enjoyed was The Golden Gate by Vikram Seth. It's rhyming, so it's not in the sense like this. It rhymes more. This rhymed less, or didn't rhyme at all, actually. So I have read books, and that's a much bigger, heftier novel, The Golden Gate. It's massively long, or it's fairly long, and that's written entirely in poetry. And also, when I was at university, I studied epic poems, like Greek and Roman epic poems, like Virgil's Aeneid or Homer's Iliad and Odyssey, which are basically novels, stories, long stories that are written in poetry form. So this wasn't a sort of format that I was completely inexperienced with. But I'm not sure if putting it in verse or made it easier to read.
Well, I just wanted to talk about the verse novel form, yeah, because I suppose it's quite, I don't know if niche is a fair word, but it feels quite niche to me. So I looked up what is a verse novel, and I ended up on a Guardian top 10 verse novels ever list by Michael Simmons Roberts. And there's a good description here where he says, it sounds like a publisher's nightmare, too long and prosaic for poetry fans, too concerned with its own form and music for readers to dip into on the train. The verse novel, like the rock opera or the sound sculpture, is the awkward child of successful parents destined to disappoint both of them. So he's sort of talking about the pitfalls of it. Like, they can be full of bad poetry, he says, because you have to put in these building blocks because it's a continuing narrative. Or it can be light on narrative and strong on poetry, but maybe not satisfying then as a novel. So he says they can be very hard work with little reward, but the best ones can be remarkable. So in his top 10, he had novels by first novels by like Pushkin and Elizabeth Barrett Browning. And the book you mentioned, I think, was on there. I'm not that familiar with them. The only one I could think of that I read was Pale Fire by Nabokov, which kind of is a verse novel, but it also has these kind of footnotes, which are a key part of it. So I don't know.
Was Pushkin Eugene Onegin?
I believe so. I'd have to double check that.
See, that's something I know the story. I've seen the opera. I've watched the film adaptation, but I've never read the... You know, I've never read it. Poor Pushkin, he's rolling in his grave. You've seen the film? yeah. I mean, I've watched the opera. I feel that's highfalutin enough to do, to be honest. But that is definitely a story. Like, it's not just a long poem. I think it's definitely a verse-like novel.
Okay, so then this one in particular, then, this verse novel in particular, Beauty Mark, so about Marilyn Monroe's life, opens with her about to sing Happy Birthday, Mr. President, which is 1962. And then it cycles back to tell her life story. So her upbringing, she spent time in foster homes. There are issues of sexual abuse, through to her first marriage and her other relationships, her modeling career, her film stardom, and so on. So that's what this book is. I liked it. I was kind of unsure going into this. I don't habitually read verse novels, for one thing. And I wondered whether Marilyn Monroe's story has just been covered so much that this would just be rehashing things that a lot of people already know. So it's really interesting actually to hear from you, Clara, that you were less familiar, because I'd read one or two biographies of Monroe before. So I think I knew the broad trajectory, even if I'm not an obsessive fan of hers. I'm not sure if I got as much out of this book as somebody who reads a lot of poetry would, because I looked at the Goodreads page and I saw one review that talked about how effective it is when the author includes a couple of rhyming poems at various points, because it marks this kind of shift. And that passed me by, at least on the conscious level. I didn't really notice that. So there may be resonances here that I don't really get for various reasons, but I did enjoy reading it, I think. So kind of unsatisfied. Is that your overall feeling on the book, is it?
I wouldn't say I'm unsatisfied with the subject matter, and I wouldn't say I'm unsatisfied with the overall themes of the book, and I wouldn't say I'm unsatisfied with the chronological arrangement of the poems. What I would say I'm unsatisfied with is the poems themselves. So I've read a lot of poetry. So although I said I've only read a few verse novels, what I have read is a lot of poetry over the years. So one of the things I felt was that it could have been more poetical. And one of the things, what I would say is, if you're going to, I mean, this is subjective, obviously, poetry, like so much art is in the eye of the beholder. You know, poetry comes in all sorts of different forms now, like music. You know, you can like heavy metal, or you can like, you know, classical symphonies, you know, so both are music, both are legitimate. So for me, I like my poetry a little bit more rich in descriptive lines. Like I felt like this was very clear, sort of, not very abstract, very clear, kind of to the point, not massively descriptive, sort of sparse kind of poetry. And that is a type of poetry. Like, that's, you know, it's perfectly legitimate. But I would have liked there to be a little bit, it'd be a little bit more lyrical, if that makes sense. There's some of it just felt very, I mean, the only word I can describe is sparse. Like, you know, and I think some of the early stuff when she was growing up as a, and her experiences as a child, were a little bit more maybe lyrical. Not all of them, though. But, like, I like the different themes where she, you know, she has one poem that's entirely called Rape, and then there's another poem that is called My Saving Grace, which is all about a friend of her mother's who's actually called Grace. And then Naked Before God, where she sort of talks about how she feels in church, that kind of thing. Like, there's another poem here called Film Noir, 1951 to 1953. And that almost felt like a chronological, clearly written account of the films that she filmed in 1951 and 1953. And, you know, with film, talking about film, there's so much potential there to be really, really sort of lyrical and descriptive and to use metaphors and similes, you know? I mean, film is such a mysterious medium, you know? You could talk about doppelgangers, your person on the screen and you in the cinema. You could talk about like color versus black and white. You could talk about how the film's made, about a film set, the busyness of a... it's almost assuming like we already know... I know you're saying... You were saying that somebody who already knows about Marilyn Monroe wouldn't get much from this. I also felt like I was kind of missing something here by not knowing about Marilyn Monroe. She mentions other people like Barbara Stanwyck. She does have one poem where she does describe famous women, doesn't she? Quite early on.
There's three of them. Yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, you could have sort of kind of clearly explained, through using sort of powerful language, how Marilyn Monroe might have felt about Barbara Stanwyck. You know, I mean, Barbara Stanwyck herself, you could write quite a lot of crazy stuff about Barbara Stanwyck. I mean, she's, you know, really interesting person. So that's why I wondered if it was for young adults who hadn't maybe had as much experience with literature.
So what the author said, so again, in that interview, she said, I read many biographies of Marilyn, ones that were narrative and others that included... collected her mementos. I approached her story chronologically, reading chapters from various references about the same period episode. Then I synthesized the information to come up with my own take. I recreated not only her voice, but also emotional backdrops for her narrative. So I thought, yeah. So on the issue of like biographical information, like I said, I'm not a Marilyn Monroe expert, so I'm not sure if there's anything here that isn't quite right. Nothing jumped out at me. And like I said, I've read one or two books about her. I thought the verse novel form was interesting in that sense, because you would have things like, there's a poem, Don't Judge a Book by Its Cover, which is about how she struggles to read, but she also has this impressive book collection. And she says, my reading choices afforded a more complex picture of me than has ever been captured on film. So that was interesting, because like, that poem unfolds over three pages, whereas I think in the books I have read about Monroe, you might get a line or two where the author will say, well, she was surprisingly well read, you know. So it seemed to me like the verse novel form was useful in some senses, because it gave the writer the scope to expand certain things. And I think it's interesting what you're saying, though. But she could expand certain things that would only get like a fleeting mention in a conventional biography. And like you say, though, she also devotes any quick attention to things like some of the film roles that in an actual biography, that would be something that gets a lot of time, doesn't it? So it's an interesting interplay, isn't it? Was that book, Don't Judge a Book by Its Cover, I wonder if that was the kind of poem you mean when you say it could have been more poetic, because it sort of becomes like a list of book titles, isn't it, later on, that poem. Is that the kind of thing you mean?
Yeah, and I think that the one that she writes about Ella Fitzgerald, I Got Rhythm. I mean, actually, the one that she writes about The 7-Year Itch is actually very poetical, and it's very sparse. I think the thing that was interesting about this was that I felt that she was really trying to write about what Marilyn would have found important. Now, we're guessing what Marilyn would have found important, because although the fact that a lot of her is written about her, and she's very well documented in history and in film, and you know, she's one of the most photographed people in the entire world, right? But she's still a cipher. People are still, years later, trying to figure out what she felt and thought about things. And her relationships with men seem to be completely mysterious. You know, some people say certain men treated her well, some people say certain men loved her, but no one's really quite sure exactly how things worked. Whereas I feel like with Elizabeth Taylor and what's his name?
Richard Burton,
who I should remember his name because he came from the same town that my great-grandmother did. Yeah, there's this joke in our family that I'm related to Richard Burton because they both had the same last name. They probably didn't. I think everyone in that part of Wales had the same last name.
It's not Port Talbot, is it? He's from around there.
Yeah, so his original last name was Jenkins.
Yeah.
Or one of his family name, I think his family name was Jenkins, and my great-grandmother's last name was Jenkins. I don't think they're in any... Jenkins is a very common Welsh name. It was... Do you know what I mean? But this is a family joke where we're distantly related to Richard Burton. But I think that Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor's romance and relationship is incredibly well documented. Do you know what I mean? And they were quite clear about how they felt about each other. It was very public. So I think a lot of stuff that we don't know about Marilyn Monroe. So that's why she's still kind of a mystery in some ways. But I think what they were trying to do, what this author was trying to do, was present the things that Marilyn found important. She spent more time on those and less time on things that... So the 7-year itch is like quite a short poem, because although it's kind of hugely impactful to cinema and everybody else, in her mind, Marilyn, it's not the thing that Marilyn focused on the most. Marilyn was more important. Was more important to Marilyn was trying to be a better reader, or, you know, trying to develop herself as an actress, or develop herself intellectually. So I think that's why those poems are maybe more developed and longer. And some of the other ones that are big, sort of, I would say that are big markers for everybody else, yeah, are actually quite small in the book, because they're not big things for Marilyn.
Yeah, and like I say, I think to some extent I liked that, because let's say a poem, there's one called Late, A Litany of Excuses, where I've seen Munro's chronic lateness talked about in other places, and I know it's not something I've ever thought about a great deal. If I have thought about it, I've probably thought about my own life, where like, I try really hard to be on time. So like when you have friends who are always late, it's really annoying. But the poem's trying to do is like contextualize some of the possible reasons for that aspect of a character. You know, I'm late because playing Marilyn Monroe is exhausting. So you get that into play between like the image and the woman throughout the book, which we can talk about a bit more. I did like that. That quote I read out from Weatherford earlier about how, you know, she had this biographical information and she also wanted to have these emotional backdrops. I mean, part of that, I don't know about what you think, but I quite liked the design touches on this book. I think some of them were quite subtle. So you'd have poems like about Mama's dream house, and you've got this kind of picture of this like partial exterior of a house with a white fence on the opposite page, and George, my first love, you get the tall grass imagery. So most of the time, I wasn't really thinking about a lot of these design touches. And then there were poems where they kind of seemed to accentuate what the text was doing, like the poem Rape, you get the black horizontal bars, don't you? Which would, I think they'd been lighter brown bars in some earlier poems. So did you have any thoughts on that aspect of the book? I suppose as an object, really.
But yeah, and the cover as well. Yeah. Like the cover is really beautiful. It's sort of this kind of shiny, glossy. Well, not glossy is the wrong word. I guess you could call it kind of sparkly, kind of shiny. It's got a sheen. That's what I'm trying to say. It's got a sheen to it. And the colours are sort of faded. But what's really very clear is her bright red lipstick and her blue eyes and the beauty mug, of course. And the beauty, it's like a dust cover. Is that what they call it? A dust cover? And then when you actually lift it up, and the beauty mark is a hole that's cut out to reflect the black hard back underneath, and when you lift it up, there is actually some words underneath that, and it says, "No one knows how it feels inside my troubled mind, no one wants to." And that's a real message. You know, you have this image of this beautiful woman who seems to be smiling, you know, kind of half closed, sort of sultry eyelids, you know, bright red lips, looking really sexy, and then you lift it up and there's this sort of sad, desperate message underneath it, written in white on a black background. And I thought that was really clever and sort of sad. The entire time I read this book and doing research about Mama Rowe, I just felt incredibly sad afterwards. This is not the thing to do during 2020. No, I'm joking. I just felt like really sorry for her. I felt like I wanted to go back in time and have a little word with her and be like, "Look, Marilyn. I think your lifestyle isn't massively healthy. Like, I think you need to like push some of these people away from you."
Well, this is it. Yeah,
you know, I think that in like so many great people in, you know, in art, in history, some of these people I feel like didn't really ever have a chance to be happy. I feel a little bit like Marilyn Monroe, like I do about Amy Winehouse when I watched that documentary about Amy Winehouse. Some of these people are very talented. I do think Marilyn Monroe is talented, and I think that they're sort of plunged into a world that they don't have the tools to be able to navigate well, you know? And I think the book actually does kind of make that clear. She's not given... If she had a different upbringing, she might have been able to manage Hollywood better, I think.
I think this is it. I think this is part of what's really interesting about the book, because so Weatherford says she wanted Marilyn to speak for herself. In life, her voice was often ignored or minimalized by studio executives. It was important to me that she be heard, that she have agency. And I think that does come through, you know, because I think everybody has this vague image of Hollywood as how it controls its stars and, you know, from that era, you know. But then I think here when we get poems like Hollywood Underbelly, 1940s, and it talks about how she was easy prey for all the liars and the phonies and the failures. And, people who had tried to buy her with money and all that kind of thing. Their belief that I had a price made me feel cheap. So I think that's one of the interesting things about the book, isn't it? Because it's first person. It's quite effective at times to have Marilyn speak about things like that, about how she didn't get offered the roles she wanted and so on. So I think things that we know about, but I think I felt like it dramatized them in quite an appropriate way. I don't know about you.
Yeah, this didn't feel sensationalist to me. And it didn't feel overly sentimental either. You know, that's another thing that was important to me. It didn't feel overly sentimental.
Yeah.
Because, you know, she was a person and she wasn't perfect, even if, you know, we might feel sympathetic towards her. You know, she wasn't perfect. I think there's a tendency, especially with, I would say with women, but actually I think it probably exists with famous men too, that, you know, like we've had this conversation before on Movie Palace, especially about actors, to put them up on a pedestal and make them these perfect people who are then invariably going to fail because they're human beings, or to make these people real sinners, you know? Yeah. It's kind of extreme. There's no sort of thing in between where somebody can just be a person, but also can be good at something, but also can have faults. And so I think this book was actually quite good at doing that. Like, she's not presented as perfect. And she's also not presented as someone who thinks that she's perfect. She's not presented as someone who's full of herself. Do you know what I mean? Like, confident in some areas, but then completely lacking confidence in others. So, and that was really well brought across. I thought the characterization of Marilyn was really well done. So regardless of whether or not you like verse or prose, the characterization was definitely there, I think.
Yeah. I think what she did well was balance both sides of the coin because, you know, she grants Monroe some agency, and I think she also recognizes the limits of that agency. So, you know, it talks a bit about how when she was at Fox and she was being given these roles that she didn't want, just churning out these roles, and it discusses the way she kind of stood up to that in some way. So she returned scripts, ignored the order to go to work and that kind of thing. But you also get stuff, don't you, that really plays up the like constructed image of her. So there's a poem, Living Up to My Name, where it acknowledges all these titles that were given to her in the press. You know, the girl most likely to Fort Alaska, most advertised girl in the world, that kind of thing. So, and she says, the accolades were Marilyn's, not mine. So I don't know, it's that kind of sense, isn't it? I think it's the big thing with movie stars. I think I mentioned Richard Dyer earlier, but his idea was that stars were kind of presented to us as being ordinary and extraordinary. They're like us, but they're not like us. So, you know, these classical film stars, they fall in and out of love like normal people do. They want to raise children or follow sport or cook or whatever it is we all do with our time. But they're also distant and inaccessible. They're glamorous. They move in these big exclusive circles. And when we come across them, we don't really meet them in real life. We come across them through things that are presenting a fiction to us in publicity articles, on posters, giant cinema screens, and so on. And I think that's really interesting in regards to Marilyn Monroe, isn't it? Because, like we said, her image became so ubiquitous. It remains quite ubiquitous because a lot is known about her off-screen travails as well. So I like the way the book kind of keeps sight of both sides of that. So, like I said, there's that poem where we get all these kind of nicknames that were given to her in the press. And then on the opposite side, the very following page is a poem called No One Malady, which talks about the fact that she had a stutter, she was dyslexic, she had colitis. So it seems like you have both sides of it. You get this recognition of the fact that this is like a constructed image. It's not reality, but she's still a human being. Someone who talks about how no one knows what it feels like to be her as well.
The book did it really well, actually. Yeah, I agree with you. And that's interesting you should pick out No One Malady, because that really struck a chord with me. So in doing my research of Marilyn Monroe, like, I found out she had endometriosis, which is a disease that or a condition that I personally feel is quite important, partly because actually I know a considerable number of women who have had endometriosis, including one of my teachers at school who really suffered from it. It's only in recent years that I've seen anybody that I know had proper treatment or been taken seriously for it. So I'm thinking, like, you know, in 2020, endometriosis is still something that is not particularly managed well by the medical world. And so I can't imagine what it was like having it back then, you know? It's a really destructive illness for a woman. It really is. And one of the things that I think is really interesting as well is this idea about, like, you know, that she's this sexual icon, you know, she's this sexual symbol to men. She's this, I felt like a lot of her sexuality was very passive and babyish, which so that's why I liked some of the other roles where in her films where you get a glimpse of her kind of being a bit more, having a bit more agency. I mean, and these are lines that are written for her, but she seems to have a bit more feistiness to her. I think one of the things that I thought was interesting, though, is this idea that it really feels like the illness is hidden. And so right after she died, I was reading about how she was going to try and get a part playing another famous actress. It wasn't Jean Harlow. It was another blonde bombshell. It was Jean Harlow. Yes, it was Jean Harlow. And so I looked up Jean Harlow because I know nothing about Jean Harlow. This is kind of awful. You're like, Clara, your classic movie knowledge is terrible. And realized that Jean Harlow has some serious health problems.
Mm.
I mean, Jean Harlow basically died from renal failure, I think.
Yeah, very young.
But the sort of, I mean, obviously it was a different era. Medicine wasn't as advanced as it is now. In fact, many historical people died from renal failure because, you know, unchecked urinary infections can lead to renal failure. A lot of kings and queens of England died from renal failure, actually.
Which ones? Do we know?
Well, I can't remember off the top of my head. I did have a book called The Death of Kings, which I read about how with modern doctors and scientists talk about looking at the symptoms of that were reported at the time, but how they thought those kings and queens had died. And a lot of the sort of kings had symptoms that were like, in keeping with basically a urinary tract infection that develops into renal failure, right? So, I mean, it's one of those things where a small thing can become a big thing because modern medicine isn't used to treat it.
Yeah.
I mean, you could cut your foot on a rusty nail and develop sepsis, you know, in 1900, and you know, whereas now you'd probably be treated better because they have more medical knowledge and medicine to be able to help you. So obviously that could be the case for Jean Harlow, but it sort of sounds like when you read about it that she was kind of neglected. Like, she was sick for a long time and people just kind of ignored it, you know, didn't fit in with the beautiful, sexy bombshell image. And I sort of feel that a little bit about Marilyn Monroe. There's this sort of stuff later on where the studio's getting upset with her because she's taking too many sick leave or too many sick days or whatever. And I'm thinking, it doesn't fit in with the industry's plan for big stars, for them to be human beings with breakable bodies or human beings with illnesses. And it doesn't fit in with the public's image. Nobody really wants to see a sick star, do they? But some of these people have health problems just like everyone else does, and some of these are quite serious. I mean, colitis is an incredibly debilitating illness. Mm-hmm. And colitis isn't a good thing to... and I think about dyslexia as well. Like, I'm dyslexic myself. I don't have the sort of problem with reading that a lot of dyslexics do, but it can feel like quite isolating, I think, you know, if everyone else easily can do something that you can't, and you think, well, you know, why can't I do this easily? Am I stupid? So I think for Marilyn, she must have felt dumb at times. But then they wanted her to be dumb, didn't they? Like, a lot of the times in the films you see, she seems like, I think she had great comic timing. I think she was a good, she could have been a good comedian, right? So I think that some of it is the fact that she had great comic timing, but some of it is also that I think they're sort of writing her as a dumb blonde. And I think that's not doing her much credit because I don't think she was dumb.
I feel bad because as a heterosexual man, I never thought of the term babyish, but I do like that side of her screen image. I do find it alluring, I'm going to say. I won't lie.
Well, that's what it's supposed to be, though. I mean, like, I don't think you should feel bad. I think that's what it's aimed at, right? Is to be alluring to men. That sort of, it's very non-threatening sexuality. It's girlish and passive. And I think that's one of the things that appeals to men, because I don't think sort of real, strong, feisty sexuality maybe appeals as much. I mean, things are different now, right? There's a whole wide spectrum of what is sexually attractive and what isn't sexually attractive. I mean, you have lots of things now, right, in media and TV. So I think people are much more accepting of lots of different things. But it's that question that you ask of, like, could you, some of the films that exist, you know, where women are playing these more sexually subservient roles, you know, could you switch them? And could you see would a film where a man is playing a more, like, sexually subservient role, would that be appealing to men? And I'm not sure it would. So I think she's non-threatening. And I think the few times that you've seen her where she's, I think about Misfits, that scene in Misfits where she's, they're going to kill the horse and she runs out into the desert. And she starts screaming and she's like distressed and she's raged. I think it was one of my most favorite moments of any Marilyn Monroe performances.
Yeah.
Cause I was like, you know what, girl, you just do it. Just let it go. Let it all out. Like, you know, but that was written for her by her husband, who I think was also not being fair to her. And it's very interesting that they didn't choose to do a close up of her during that. They film her from a distance,
right,
in her rage, and I think that's important because no one really wants to get that close, right? They don't really want to know how upset Marilyn Monroe is about something. Maybe from a distance, but they want to see her sexuality up close instead, if you see what I'm saying.
I do like threatening women as well, just to be clear.
Well, I mean, the upside of this is, right, Joan Crawford and Barbara Stanwyck, right?
I like, yeah.
Who aren't threatening, but are definitely more, they have more agency in their sexuality. I mean, Joan Crawford is a very commanding woman. She may be sexually alluring, I guess, or beautiful, but she's not babyish, is she? So
no. No, I think this has been argued about Monroe, but I think people have put forward the idea that she appeals more to men than to women for precisely that reason. A lot of women can't relate to her. Would be the idea, I suppose, or on one level. All I'm trying to say is I don't want to be dishonest and lose sight of the fact that I look at pictures of her, or I look at her in certain films, and, you know, I think she can take people's breath away. She can take my breath away. That's all I'm trying to say.
She's very beautiful. I mean, yeah. Aside from the sexual attitude, just she is very beautiful. I think also she's physically very there. Do you know what I mean? In the sense that she's not. Not that I'm trying to discriminate against women who are skinny or anything, but she's like, she takes up space, you know, she's very ample. So, you know, you feel like she's a real living, breathing person, sexual person, as opposed to like a fashion model, you know, who's just kind of there to advertise clothes or something. Like when you see her modeling pictures, she looks almost animalistic, kind of like a very voluptuous, beautiful being. Yeah. I think that's kind of part of her appeal as well.
And I think the book gets at it quite well. Like, for instance, there's a poem called, he's towards the back, I think, Secrets of Style, where she's kind of talking about how she creates a glamorous image. And it's like, it goes back to what I was saying about that kind of dichotomy, where it's like, shop at Saks Fifth Avenue, Bergdorf Goodman, Bonwit Teller, or New York Boutique. So obviously not everybody can do that. So it's kind of extraordinary in that sense. But it's also stuff like place marbles in bras or buttons inside dresses to the fake nipples, you know, which is, I think, I would imagine is much more achievable for a lot of people. So she's both of those things. She's like the unbelievably glamorous sex symbol, the woman who's playing up to an image she's expected to maintain, which I think comes through in the book.
I guess there's also that issue, though, isn't there? Like, you shouldn't have to be one or the other. Like, you shouldn't have to sacrifice being taken seriously or being sexy. And, you know, I'm sure there's parts of her that really, I'm sure she really loved being sexy. I'm sure she loved the attention. Do you know what I mean? I mean, most actors and actresses, not all of them, obviously, but a lot of them love attention. You know, they're one of the reasons why they get into show business is they want an audience. And so I'm sure she loved that. And I'm sure she loved being attracting men. I mean, it's kind of nice to be thought of as attractive, right? But it's like, she's only really allowed to be one thing, you know? She can't be that and smart, or she can't be that and a serious actress. And I guess what I wondered is, are there any male stars around that time who were sort of really pushed into a box, who were like, they're just really handsome men and they're not expected to be anything else, or they're just really sort of brilliant actors and they're not expected to be, I don't know, attractive. Do you know what I mean? So,
yeah, I just Googled 1950s male heartthrobs. I think you're Rock Hudson, would we say? I don't know.
I guess Rock Hudson wasn't necessarily, he was kind of known for one sort of thing, wasn't he, really, I suppose.
I think you're right, though, that, like, you saw about the boxes she was put into, and I think that's true. And I think the other point is, like, the boxes that female stars were put into had shorter shelf lives as well. They would kind of be cycled out of their prime stardom a bit quicker, wouldn't they, I think? So I think that's fair. I think it shifts, doesn't it, more after a certain time. I think when you get to the 70s onwards, I think it becomes more accepted that you get these stars, they do starry things, but they can also go off and do character actor roles, or they can do a film where they're in a supporting role and so on and so forth. So I think
for
this era, she's kind of emblematic, though, isn't she, of the tensions of being... Maybe she's the most dramatic example in certain respects of being a woman in Hollywood at that time. I think it's true. It's sad as I suppose we got this foreknowledge during the book. Like I say, it's framed as kind of a flashback, but we sort of know where it's going, don't we? And there are certain comments that kind of call to mind what's going to happen to her and so on. And I don't know. I came away from the book. Would you say it's quite a downbeat book, or would it kind of make you feel? I don't know.
Yeah, I think it is. But then I think there's no other way it could be. Like. Yeah. I don't think that I don't think she had a happy life, and I don't think she had a happy story. And I think that I'd like to celebrate her and think, you know, of all the things she achieved and what an amazing person that she probably was. But it's hard for me to do that because the things that she's most famous for are
doing things you don't like, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah, and also things that I don't think were necessarily healthy for her. There's a big part of me that I feels incredibly sad about the backstory with the mental illness and her family, and the mental illness that I think she was experiencing for a lot of her life.
Yeah.
I just feel like, if she was alive today, I don't even know if that's even the case, because sometimes, well, in a lot of cases, our mental health treatment of people is still not brilliant, but it's much better than it was then. And I think that, even in my own family, like, my grandmother suffered from severe mental illness, and the treatment that she received, I think people were trying their best, but like, she had electric shock treatment, you know, and nowadays, I think for what she had then, they would never give her electric shock treatment. I mean, the medication that they can give people for mental illness now, the therapy that they can give people, the understanding of mental illness is so much better than it was. And I think some of the things that she's like expressing and experiencing are just things that are very understandable now. And it sounds like she had severe anxiety for most of her life. And I just think her family, that chronic history of mental illness in her family, I mean, I don't know how she could have escaped that without some support, some proper mental health treatment. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah. And especially in this industry, I was thinking earlier when you were talking about it, but I'm thinking of all the episodes I've done, and there are so many when you come across like anecdotes and things. Like when we talked about, I did an episode on The Wizard of Oz, and you read about how Judy Garland was treated by MGM, or Singing in the Rain, and Debbie Reynolds being made to dance until her feet were bleeding, and that kind of thing. And you realize how it's quite easy to lionize some of those things, not those particular things, but you talk about the industrial churn of Hollywood and how it was like the dream factory, you know, and it actually conceals a really dark kind of underbelly and undertow, doesn't it? Where these people are being treated in many cases abhorrently, you know?
Yeah, and there seems to be, the more I read about it, there seems to be more and more stories about people doing things in offices to get parts, you know? Like, yeah. I mean, just the other day I was reading about Shirley Temple, about how when she was a little girl, a movie executive or a producer or something exposed himself to her when she was a little girl. I'm thinking, even Shirley Temple, you know, who's not it wasn't a sex symbol, not at that point anyway. Well, I don't think Shirley Temple was ever a sex symbol, but do you know what I mean? Like, she grew up to be a woman. I guess she grew up to be an adult, but like, she wasn't, do you know what I mean? She wasn't known for being sexy in film. She was a little girl. She's cute, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But like, I just think how much of that must have gone on. People were being asked to sacrifice things in order to be able to succeed in Hollywood, but sacrifice things that perhaps maybe they shouldn't have had to sacrifice, and sacrifice things that, I don't know, were going to lead to mental, physical distress, or going to lead to long-term, trauma. Mm. I don't know. I guess, and the other thing as well, also the way that Marilyn Monroe died through an overdose of barbiturates. I mean, I know there's all these conspiracy theories about her death, but that also feels ugly to me, this hypothesizing about this poor woman's death as if her death is one of the most important things about her, right? It's very ghoulish and very voyeuristic, right? But I think that the barbiturates usage, you know, if you Google barbiturates usage, Clara, such an awful Googler, but if you Google barbiturates usage, a lot of people have died, famous people have died from barbiturates, overdose of barbiturates, through accident or through deliberate means, like through suicide as well, you know, for suicidal reasons. And it's just the readily available drugs in show business. I think all these people should not be near drugs so easily. Do you know what I mean? Like, I think that, and then the not much checking up on how these people are taking the drugs, like the dosage or how often they're taking them, or there seems to be a lack of care in that respect. You know, the drugs that are available, the drugs being pushed onto them, and then the drugs that no one's really kind of keeping track or measuring how much the drugs are being taken. I just think it's sort of a tragedy, really.
Well, and the tragedy, because, I mean, film star images outlast the life of the person behind them, don't they? But with Marilyn Monroe, it is tragic because she didn't grow old or older, and it's kind of her image is kind of frozen, you know, at how it was in the 50s and early 60s, I suppose.
I do wonder what she would have thought, what she would think now. She came back and she could see her face, like, printed
coffee
across
mugs and, yeah.
coffee mugs, and she might feel kind of horrible about it. I mean, she might feel like it's like taking pieces of her and sticking her everywhere. I mean, or she might not. I mean, she might be like, well, that's not me. I don't care. Or, you know, at least I'm not forgotten. I don't know. She might. I do sometimes wonder a little bit, like I do, like another person I wonder about is Che Guevara. This is not the same kind of thing at all, but Che Guevara was like a communist, right? And I wonder how he'd feel about how capitalists make a lot of money from his image, you know, or even like Van Gogh, you know, Van Gogh's sunflowers replicated everywhere. He might be kind of horrified. So I think, I do sometimes wonder what they'd think if they could come back and take a look.
Well, just on the book, finally, Clara, I suppose, I mean, we talked a bit about whether younger readers would be drawn to this, whether it would appeal to them. I'm wondering if the biggest or one of the biggest constituencies here for this book is like people who maybe like us are, you know, interested in filmmaking of this era, interested in these people. I'm wondering if they'll get just as much from and they might know a lot about Marilyn Monroe, potentially. I wonder if they will enjoy this as much, if not more, than, let's say, your grade 9, 10, 11 teenagers. I don't know. Would you recommend this to people with similar interests to us, I guess is what I mean.
Yeah, I think I would, actually. I think I would. I think if you know a lot about Marilyn Monroe, you may not get much from this. But I think that I would recommend it to friends of mine who like classic film but don't necessarily know much about Marilyn Monroe. I don't think I would recommend it to 14-year-olds. I'm sorry to the author for that. But although, on the other hand, though, it's been a long time since I was 14, and I was a very sheltered 14-year-old. I'm not saying I didn't. I mean, I studied periods of dark history in school. I studied, you know, like world wars and everything. So it wasn't like I wasn't aware that some of these, you know, that the abuse happened to people or that people took drugs. It wasn't like I wasn't aware of some of that. But this is an awfully sad story to give to a 14-year-old, especially a 14-year-old girl. And I think I would have, if I was talking to my 14-year-old self, I think I'd say wait a few years, wait until you're maybe 17 or 18 and give myself a little bit more innocence, teenage innocence, before I start realizing how cruel the adult world can be. However, 14-year-olds now, I don't think necessarily are as innocent. I think with social media, celebrity, I don't know what you'd call it, like exposure, the way it is now, with the current political situation that we have around the world, you know, with I mean, even something like the pandemic with news, global warming, and everything. I feel like teenagers nowadays are already living in the adult world, even when they aren't adults. And I feel very sad about that. I wish they had wish they could have more of the innocent upbringing that I had when I was younger. I grew up without, I should emphasize to our listeners that I grew up without smartphones and without social media. There was the internet, but it wasn't the same internet that you have now. And so I think when I watched Marilyn Monroe as a kid, I didn't really think about the fact that she died young. I didn't think about how she'd been abused. I didn't know any of that. I just saw her as this beautiful blonde woman in a Western singing with a guitar, you know, falling in love with Robert Mitchum. And so maybe this would appeal to 14-year-olds. Maybe 14-year-olds already know about this sort of thing. And so this is helping to clarify it for them or helping to put it in context, maybe.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I think I'm a couple of years younger than you, but I was kind of in that crossover where, as I was in high school, mobile phones were becoming more commonplace. And so I can remember going out to play like all day, not having a phone. And that, and I think there was a more innocent time, wasn't it? I don't know any 14-year-olds these days. I guess I'd have to judge it on a person-by-person basis. But I wonder if the book, because it does sort of foster some empathy, I don't know. I think it would depend how worldly the teenager was. I would have to think about it.
I mean, I guess you could say one of the first examples I had of real overt sexuality as a teenager was Britney Spears. So, yeah. And I think it's not unusual now for sort of movie stars or pop stars that are in the world of whose fans are children. It's not unusual for them to be overtly sexual or to have serious problems or issues, you know? Yeah. So, I don't know if that, you know, was always the case when, I mean, I think there were issues with people. I mean, well, we now know there were lots of people in our youth doing dodgy things, if you think about, like...
Yeah.
But at the time, I didn't know some of that stuff. So, whereas I'm wondering if today's teenagers are a little bit more streetwise, a little bit more worldwise, you know, and could actually take something like this and learn from it rather than finding it...
Horrifying,
distressing.
No, I think so. I think a lot of 14-year-olds have seen things like hardcore pornography already, sadly. But I think a lot of teenagers are exposed to things like that really early. And when I was a kid, like looking at rude words in the dictionary was about as far as it went, you know. I think that for people who, I said, people who like classic film and are into star biographies and that kind of thing, I think if you've read like a bunch of Marilyn Monroe biographies, I think, and you keep buying them, I would say maybe give this a go because, like I said, it's getting into some different areas. It's expanding certain things that just get covered in passing in the biographies. So it might be a nice supplement to your Marilyn Monroe, you know, book collection if you have one. So I think I would recommend it on those grounds, yeah. Unless you had any further thoughts on the book, Clara, I guess we could wrap up there and you could tell us where we could find you online.
Yes, so you can find me online on Twitter at Clara Jean MC. I also host a podcast called The Tales We Tell, which is all about women and gender in film and fiction. And you can find that on Twitter at The Tales Podcast and also on podcast providers, including iTunes.
And what kind of episodes have you got like in the pipeline, Clara, for that?
So I've got quite a few, actually. It's one of those situations where you record a lot and then you're like, oh, now I got to edit it all. So I've got one coming up on Monday, actually, about Jessica Jones, the Netflix series, which is interesting because it's about a female character who is generally seen as initially unlikable and talk about female sort of anger on television and exposure to female anger. I've got one that I want to release about M from the James Bond universe, unfortunately I'm waiting for the James Bond film to be released because I want to time it perfectly. But yeah, all sorts of new episodes ready to release in the next coming months. Someday I hope to do maybe an episode about Marilyn Monroe now that my interest has been piqued by this book. So yes.
Good. Yeah, great stuff. And I can recommend the podcast as well, listeners, because it's really good. All right, that's it for this episode of the Movie Palace. You can find us in the usual places. So we're on Twitter at Movie Palace Pod. Also on Facebook and on Instagram. We'll be back soon. I think our next episode, we're going to take a look at the 2020 adaptation of Rebecca, actually. So we're taking a hop into the present day. I hope you can join us next time, listeners, when the curtain rises once again at the Movie Palace.
Elsewhere, and we made this. Back to the decade.
And so far, I'll knock on wood, the recipe for not choking in the playoffs has been not have fans in the stands. So it's working for him.
Nice.
At that note,
yeah, fuck it, man. We gotta go back to the decade. How long have we been in here in the present?
Present. We've been in the present for too long. Let's hit the decade rewind.
We've been away for so long. We're too like, oh God, what have we done? All right, let's get out of here. Back to the decade.
Cerebral Jukebox.
While I was listening to my Walkman, she started handing me cassette tapes that I should be listening to, playing me lots of great music. And I, you know, at the end of that, I asked if I could bring her a cassette tape into school so that she could copy me some stuff onto a cassette tape, and which she did a couple of weeks later. And basically, that cassette tape, which I've still got, formed much of my music taste probably from then till now.
Life's milestones.
Yeah, freeze me, because then they'll cure death one day. And then my wife, I've said that to my wife, and she says, yeah, but I'll be long dead. I said, yes, but they'll have holograms then. So, you know, I can recreate you as a hologram. She said, oh yeah, so what if you die when you're 75, 80? Are you going to recreate 75, 80-year-old me? I said, well, no. I'll create, like, 30-year-old you. So I'll basically become an immortal Bernie Eccleston in, like, the year 3000.
Okay, good. I've had some wonderful answers for this, but that's...
Check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This podcast network.